Hi guys, welcome back to Gen Z Talks, the podcast where I invite Gen Zs or young people from all over the world to have meaningful conversations on topics concerning young adults in different cultures. Thank you to all the listeners who liked and followed this podcast. Please enjoy today's episode on mental health among college students in the United States. Hi guys, welcome back to episode 3 of Gen Z Talks. I'm the host, Yuli. Today, I invited two of my friends to discuss mental health issues among college students in higher education. Let's welcome Zania and Anna.
Hi, I'm Zania. I'm from Southern California. I'm studying computer science at Georgetown and currently Zooming from home.
Hi, my name is Anna. I'm a senior in the SFS at Georgetown as well. And
SFS, please explain to our listeners.
Oh my God, Georgetown, it's many abbreviations. The School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, and I am currently calling in from Bangkok, Thailand.
Oh, Bangkok. Okay, so let's start with how we got to know each other. Zania, how did you know me? What was our story?
Honestly, all I remember is that I think I knew of you in freshman year just because, like, everybody in their freshman year tries to figure out who else they could possibly be friends with. Yeah. I think, like, maybe sophomore or junior year, I think I met you through Sam because she mentioned that you were starting to do CompSci.
Yeah. I think I first met you at the Hot Pot at Sam's birthday party. That's when I first started, like, talking to you, I think. I don't think I knew you in freshman year at all.
I don't think we actually met, but I was like, I feel like I heard your name, but like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I heard your name from, like, Japanese Network, JNED. Okay, what about Anna?
We live on the same floor freshman year.
Oh, yeah.
In rooms that are adjacent to each other. Technically, there was one room in between.
Yeah.
But that was an interesting freshman year. We were in, like, what's the word for it? A living learning community for culture and performance. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that year we didn't get to do that many activities regarding cultures and performance.
I mean, we did get, like, free tickets for school shows, but I was expecting more, like, free tickets, you know, for the Kennedy Center or something.
We were definitely not marketed properly.
Okay, I guess we can start our topic today involving mental health. So I guess if you guys want to start us off with giving us an overarching picture of your journey with mental health.
Sure. What do I want to talk first? I guess, like, the first part of my life that I was more aware of mental health was probably, like, in middle school, which kind of sounds cliche, but, like, is that, like, well, I mean, like, it is the puberty point and, like, whatever, but, like, probably from then on, and I think it was mostly, like, academic, like, fueled, yeah. You know, like, all the stresses of people telling you that you're gonna soon figure out what you want to do for your life.
Yeah.
But yeah, since then it's just become more prevalent, I guess, like, with growing stress, especially in college, and, like, trying to figure out who you want to be and, like, what kind of friends you want to have.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, like, the point at which I really started focusing on it, though, was only, like, freshman fall, because a lot of stuff, like, happened in terms of, like, friendship groups and, like, things I was trying to figure out. So that was definitely the really low point where I really had to face it. And since then, just been trying to be present, focus on it, make it better.
Mm-hmm. I think freshman year is
like a period that probably a lot of people struggled through. Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of adjustment and a lot of friendship and like also academic stuff adjustment going on. So
yeah, I expected it to be more of like the academic standpoint, because like a lot of my high school teachers were like, oh, like college classes are different. It wasn't really that for me though. It was mostly like I didn't expect people, I guess, to have like their own motives be so present in how they interact with others.
Interesting.
So yeah,
maybe that's just a Georgetown thing, not gonna lie.
Maybe.
Yes, what I wanted to discuss too, whether it's like a more like elite institution thing or just like college students in general, I feel like.
I don't know, like I have friends who go to public schools in California and like they seem to have less stories about social dynamics.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. What about in high school? Did you really pay attention to your mental health in high school, or like did you just write through it without noticing?
I wouldn't say like I didn't notice, but I think I had an easier time kind of like pushing it off. I guess like, yeah, overriding it with like the focus of like, oh, I need to do all these advanced classes, or I need to focus on my college apps or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would assume college is even busier than high school. Then like, why did you like start focusing more on mental health in college than high school?
I think a big factor of it is like being away from home. Like at home, like even now, it's a lot harder for me to like sit down and think about it because there's just more going on with like my family. And like, I'm not a super open person about it with my family just because of different cultural aspects and things I remember from growing up and hearing stuff about it. But like being like at Georgetown and like with everything that happened, like there was a lot more space to just sit and be like, oh, like how do I feel about the stuff that's happening right now, like instead of just being like, oh, I just have to deal with it and pass it.
That's true. I think being away from family is definitely makes you have more personal space and sort of do introspection and think about yourself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess we can talk more about family later, but now let's make Anna tell her story.
So I feel like the concept of mental health was completely foreign to me until I arrived in the United States for college. Like I grew up in Thailand, I grew up in Bangkok, and how the mental health was discussed here, at least from my personal experience being raised Buddhist, is that it's all about, you know, mindfulness, it's a state of suffering, and if through Buddhist practice you'll be able to overcome that suffering, or at least live with it. But I didn't really understand mental health as quote-unquote a health problem until I arrived in the United States. And my first introduction to the term was when I was at prep school. I did a PG year, like a postgraduate year. It's like a year that you repeat your senior year at a prep school so that you can prepare yourself to apply for American colleges. This actually exists in many New England preparatory schools because a lot of international students need time to transition from their own, you know, school system to the American school system because it's very different. In preparatory school, because I live in a dorm, like one of my dorm advisors, who's a professor at the prep school, she approached me and she's like, Anna, like I noticed that you've been going to the restroom every time after you eat. Is there anything I can talk to you about? And that was when I learned I have an eating disorder. And I was like, I didn't know what an eating disorder was. Like, I had no idea. Mm. Like, the term did not exist. The concept of mental health did not exist before that moment. And then I had to go through this whole entire lecture where my dorm advisor eventually, you know, introduced me to the counseling center on that preparatory school. So that was my first introduction. And it really felt foreign to me then, because the stigmatization of mental health as a concept, I mean, this was back in 2016, was not as, it's not as it's much more accepted now with the magic of the social internet, but it's not, the awareness isn't as high back then. So when I had to call my parents and be like, ha ha ha, I have this thing, now I have a counselor and now I'm getting through it, was definitely very challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And my whole entire year at the preparatory school, with all the culture shock, with all the homesickness, with all the pressure of trying to apply to university, also the pressure from my scholarship program, which I received that enabled me to study abroad in the United States, basically made that year very hard for me. But the fact that I was privileged enough to attend a preparatory school that has their own counseling system, counseling service, and was able to work with a counselor, it really got me through that year. And it really shows my experience really shows how much, like, how important it is for us to have a language to describe our experience, right? Like, I didn't have a language to describe, like, the fact that I have an eating disorder. But because someone identify it to me and tell me that that is something that can be fixed and I can become better and I can recover from it. Mm-hmm. That's why I feel like, you know, sometimes there's always debates about whether diagnosis are helpful or not. And I don't know where I stand about the debate yet, but at least for this particular issue that I have, like, having that language that explains what I am experiencing was incredibly helpful. And I mean, I don't have it anymore. So it's just all about identifying it. Like, sometimes you have an issue, but you don't know what that issue is. So you don't know how to address it.
Exactly. I definitely agree. Props to your dorm supervisor or whatever you call her, though.
Yeah,
I think it's so good for her to, like, at least point out, like, actually care about you and, like, point out your problem.
I mean, since it's a dorm environment, like, sometimes RAs, as well as dorm advisor, they notice your behavior, right?
Yeah, but I feel like at Georgetown, like, our RA, in my personal experience, I haven't, like, had a lot of personal contact with our RAs.
Yeah, I think it's, like, it's a question of, like, whether they take the initiative, because she totally could have chosen to, like, not say anything.
I feel like with my dorm advisor, it's more of the prep school policy, just because the preparatory school that I went to had a lot of cases, and there's pretty much, like, a mental health issue there.
Mm-hmm.
So since it's very competitive and a lot of students do take medical leave, in my personal experience, it's very jarring, because that's my first year in the United States, right? And then, like, I had this friend in my dorm who I'm very close with, and then she disappeared for no reason. And then I text her on Messenger, and she's like, I took medical leave, and then she's gone. And then there's also another friend at that school, and then she's gone by the second semester. So I was like, wow, there's definitely something going on in the preparatory school system that needs to be fixed. I mean, this is gonna sound a little bit arrogant of me, but I would say that the stress level at Georgetown is much lower than the stress level at my preparatory school. Like, it's horrible.
Yeah, I imagine there's so much competition there.
It's basically college level competition of kids trying to get into clubs and, like, overwhelming themselves with the grind culture, but at high school level, where your maturity level isn't that high.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's pretty rough. But with that experience, I definitely become much more wary of the college grind culture, because I already had the grind culture in preparatory school. So when I entered college, I felt like I am not going to fall into that grind culture, or else I am going to fall back into the loop that I experienced in preparatory school. So, I mean, they're called preparatory schools for a reason.
Oh my, that's true. I think I definitely identify with what you talked about the language around the stuff that you didn't even realize, because I think I experienced the same thing when I was in before I came to US. Basically, I'm not sure if it's because, you know, I got into college and I learned these terms, or if it's because I started receiving U.S. education and there's more conversations in the U.S. around mental health than China. But when I was in China, I definitely agree with the stigmatization around the mental health issues, because they, because like whenever you say you have mental health issues, they just assume, oh, like something wrong with your brain or whatever. And there's not enough language in China, like even now with my friends, to talk about mental health. Like, you know how it's completely fine, like on our Insta stories, we usually, like, I posted about seasonal affective disorder before, because I think that affects me greatly. Like,
I have a lot of that.
I think it's very common, actually, around people, because, like, in the winter, you know, like when the sun sets super early, you just feel like you haven't done anything. Like,
yeah, like there's a certain biological effect.
I'm from Bangkok, like adjusting to this whole cold weather in itself is like stressful.
At least you're in Bangkok now.
I mean, I do miss snow though. I do not miss the early sunset.
Yeah, it snowed here yesterday. So like continuing my topic, I was posting on my Insta stories on like seasonal affective disorder, and I was posting about burnouts and stuff, and I said, I was like, it's fine, like a lot of people get it, so you're not alone. But I feel like in China, in our social media, so in China we use WeChat mostly, but in our social media, basically nobody ever talks about mental health problems. I think same with, it's not related to today's theme, but in terms of the language awareness problem, same with the gender equality problem, in my opinion. Because when I was in China, I remember in middle school, my head teacher, or like most of the teachers, including female teachers, they would say girls would do fine in seventh grade, but in eighth grade, with the addition of physics and complicated math, like girls will fall behind and it's normal, it's okay. They're just saying that. All the girls accepted it. I accepted it too. So I don't know if it was like a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know. I was just like, oh, if they say that girls are going to fall behind, then the pattern that I'm doing right now, falling behind, is fine because it's justified, so I don't have to work as hard. I don't know if I went into this perpetual cycle, but it was just, yeah, the language was never addressed, like this kind of gender bias. It was not until I like received my college education at Georgetown that I realized like this kind of language is really wrong, and we should have more awareness of the gender equality issue, because nobody ever realized what they were saying was wrong in my middle school.
Well, I think it's also like I agree with Anna saying about like putting a name to stuff, like,
yeah,
diagnoses are kind of questionable, because sometimes like the medical side of getting a diagnosis is not necessarily the most helpful. But I think like for both situations, it's kind of like a combination of like social conditioning and not having the label. Like, I think, like, you know, from my high school experience where I kind of pushed it away, I think part of it was the program I was in high school was very like, oh, you're gonna be stressed and like you're gonna lose sleep and you're gonna be super overwhelmed when you start doing your college applications. Like, they just like didn't support or like get more awareness for the notion that like, you know, you don't have to feel so overwhelmed all the time.
Yeah.
But they also didn't label it as like, you know, sometimes people develop anxiety or depression. And it's like, I didn't really get to read those labels until freshman year, where I was like hearing about all the Georgetown health stuff, where they're like, oh, like all the different parts of being a healthy person.
I just wanted to ask a follow-up question. I heard when Zinia was talking about it, Anna was saying, was nodding her head too, when you guys talked about how the medical side of the diagnosis is not as ideal. Could you guys add more to it?
It's more like a double-edged sword, because on one side, it can be useful when you need accommodations and when you are trying to explain your condition to someone else, but it's also can become very binding or become stigmatized, because the most important thing right now is to try to fight the stigma. And with anxiety and depression, the stigma and the taboo that surrounds that those two labels are becoming smaller and smaller, but they still exist. But with more severe mental health issues, like if you have that particular label, it can really backfire against you. So I feel like those type of labels, it's helpful, but it's all, it also can be dangerous as long as the taboo and stigmatization of mental health is still there. So we need to work towards, you know, destigmatization.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's also like, you know, it's useful to have the label for yourself, right? Like, it's very useful to be able to say like, oh, like I have anxiety and that's like not me. It's something I'm struggling with. Right. But then like, you know, I am not someone who has been medically diagnosed. And like part of the reason I've avoided it is, you know, the stigma of like when you need to, you know, either put on like your medical profile or when you're like, applying for jobs. And like, there's always the worry that the stigma will outweigh that there's like medical science behind. Because there's plenty of stigma about like anxiety, depression, where like either you're unreliable or you're lazy. And it's like, those are symptoms of the issue, not necessarily the person.
I actually had, I actually tried the test, the diagnosis test, or whether or not I have ADD, ADHD. And from what I've heard from the doctor that was there, like she said that unless the condition is like severely impacting your life, they don't really want to put a medical diagnosis for you because they understand the taboo that comes with it. So I mean, I'm not technically diagnosed with ADD or ADHD from that testing, but it's that particular sentence itself like really, really, you know, awakened something in me that that's why I mean, even the doctors are avoiding to put these labels on people because the taboo is still pretty strong.
That's so surprising.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how your family, your guys' family, approach your mental health concerns. In my personal experience, I remember in middle school or high school, whenever I told my mom that I was really exhausted from school, my mom would always say, oh, it's because, like, you're not placing your school at your priority, or like it's always your fault. Like, if you just try a little bit harder, you will overcome it. Just this kind of stuff.
For me, for like context, like I am Chinese and Indonesian. So, like, the culture in my household was never really like supportive of acknowledging mental health as like an issue. Like, it was definitely the stigma of like, oh, it's a disorder, it's a disease. For anybody to like be diagnosed with that, or for anybody to say they struggle with it or went to therapy. So it wasn't something that I felt comfortable talking about in my house for a long time. And really the only thing that changed that was like many of the students at Georgetown, you know, like high achievers, I was one of the valedictorians for my school, and I had to give a speech, and I decided to talk about having anxiety and depression. I did not vet that with my parents at all. I think the only person who heard it before the actual ceremony was my principal. So I kind of like hit him with it without any warning. I think the only person in my family who wasn't shocked was my sister. But obviously,
that's such a power move though.
Because I wasn't like really comfortable like bringing it up, like, you know, like how do you sit down at dinner and be like, yeah, sometimes, you know, I kind of want to die, and I know that's a problem. Like,
oh my,
you know,
yeah.
So like, I just decided to talk about it then and there, like, you know, the final send off. And then kind of after that,
I imagine how surprised your family would be, like, after they hear you on stage talking to a whole school, but without telling your family.
Yeah. It was an interesting ride home. my sister cried because she didn't realize that I like also went through it. But, you know, my parents slowly started to have those conversations and, like, you know, like hint at it when they talked. And then, like, it became a little bit more accepted.
For me. Oh, sorry. I keep jumping. I'm horrible with these contextual calls. But yeah, for me, as I mentioned, my parents are really Buddhist, So whenever stress becomes an issue or whenever I seem very anxious or depressed, they always tell me to be like, oh, yeah, calm down, go like pray to the Buddha, go meditate, you know, breathe in and breathe out and everything's going to be fine. Mm-hmm. And why that is definitely helpful in addressing some of the issues that I have, the being isolated from your parents because you're studying abroad and you don't have that support, it's very hard. And sometimes some issues are just so big that simply meditation cannot address everything. Like, I wouldn't say that I can solve my eating disorder with through meditating afterwards, but it's more about being mindful when you eat and you understand that you have a healthy relationship with food. But it's different, because like when you address something from quote unquote a spiritual aspect and then you express something from more of a secular aspect, there are both pros and cons to both approaches. But I feel like using only one way or the other, at least for me, doesn't work. I need to combine them together. Like a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy, at least for me, is very similar to mindfulness, like mindfulness practice that I'm raised with, but framing it as something that is helping me address my own mental health instead of, you know, some form of karma or some form of like personal failing. It's definitely much more healthier, a healthier way of looking at that particular problem. Because sometimes with Buddhist teachings, like I know it takes practice, but sometimes it's very easy to put blame on yourself for not being able to comprehend those particular concepts. Like for example, like I know that suffering is inevitable, but sometimes I just want to evade this suffering. It can be addressed, right? Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's I would say it's, at least from the Buddhist tradition that I'm raised in, it's just too aesthetic for the American lifestyle. It's very hard to adapt to. And sometimes I actually think about this a lot, since, I mean, my involvement at Georgetown is mostly in the religious realm and the mental health realm. And I feel like a lot of the mental health issues that college students experience, it definitely comes from like the grind culture, as well as a very competitive nature of higher education. But since you cannot, since cultural shift or like changing the academic setting is not going to happen overnight, like providing good mental health services as well as like good spiritual support is definitely important for students to get through this very challenging time period of their lives.
Mm-hmm. So correct me if I'm wrong, I know a little bit about Buddhism, which is about the suffering. So since your parents believe in Buddhism, like, is suffering like a normal part in your life? And that's why your parents were saying, like, if you are struggling with these problems, then it's normal?
Yeah, it's like the first teaching of the Buddha. It's like, yeah, suffering is like human, like the human condition is suffering, right? So so it's less about trying to live a happy life, but more about how to address the suffering and new experience. That's how I would summarize it. So when I'm sad or when I'm very, you know, not functioning, my parents would be like, this will pass, this will eventually get better. But sometimes those comments can turn against you, right? Sometimes when you are really sad, it's like hearing that you'll get better doesn't necessarily,
it kind of like disregards the feeling.
Yes, exactly. So that's exactly why I was saying that it needs to go side by side, because even though this form of support that my parents have provided me is nice, it sometimes does disregard the fact that it's a very painful time, and it's a time that one does not want to be in.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting, the interaction between religions and our modern mental health problems. So what were some of the most difficult parts of coping or just sharing about your problems?
I think like there's two big difficult things in my own experience. Like one of them is like, I think it's like a broader thing, but like the conflict between trying to keep that mindset that like we mentioned of like oh, like this is not gonna last forever, like this is not who I am, like, you know, mm-hmm. trying to keep that mindset of like, oh, like things will get better, but also like letting yourself go through it. Like I think that's a big thing. Mm-hmm. Like I've had anxiety attacks and like panic attacks, and mm-hmm. like one of the biggest things that people try to tell you is like you have to experience it, like you can't suppress it or like try to pretend like it's not happening, because that actually makes it worse. Mm. So I think like it's that kind of dichotomy of like trying to figure out how to go through it without letting it consume like your mindset or like your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
But then like the other part is like the biggest thing about trying to get better is that you have to want to get better.
Right.
And that's such a hard thing to like commit to when like, especially like with anxiety and depression, like your mindset just fully becomes like, you know, none of it is worth it, or like I can't do any of it.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you keep that mindset of like, I want to get better while also feeling like nothing is going to turn out correctly?
Mm-hmm.
I definitely feel like, I don't know whether this is an appropriate way of framing it, but like Gen Z, Gen Zoomer, like we're also known as the doomers, right? Like we're known for being sad, depressed, and anxious. And there's definitely almost like a romanticization of this particular feeling of dread and sadness and mm-hmm. as a generation. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, whereas like positivity is very like mocked upon or like frowned upon, whereas like, oh, that's kind of cringe for you to be that positive. Can someone be that positive? Is that,
I agree.
There's at least on the internet, it's definitely that particular mindset. And I felt like for me to try to like acknowledge that it's not cringe to be positive, and it's actually very hard, because I definitely feel like I definitely fall into the romanticization of anxiety and depression at times. And when I'm exactly experiencing it, I'd be like, no way, I do not want to, like, I need to overcome this. There's nothing wrong with having your life managed and organized and living a healthy lifestyle, even though that might be cringe according to the doomer logic. So I don't know whether that even makes sense, but that's definitely something I really do struggle with. And the other one that I struggle with is under the debate whether like the anxiety is something I experience, or is it part of my personality? What does it make me who I am? That is also like a very weird thing to think about, because I know that I've been anxious as far as I can remember, but that doesn't mean that I can like I need to completely get rid of it, but more like keep it managed in a way that doesn't like affect my daily life and makes my interaction with other people I care about and society much more pleasant to deal with is definitely the goal. So I feel like those are the two things, like how do I not glorify having anxiety and depression because it's edge and it's cooler than being like hippie girl, positive vibes, sunshine and unicorns, and how do I understand it's also a part of me, but I need to learn to have a much like a healthier way of dealing with it.
Yeah, I think thinking back to what Zania said about the like having the mindset, like convincing yourself is also part of the reason why I wanted to talk about these problems and make our listeners like just kind of realize and listen to what you guys think are like some of the best ways that your friends or your family can do to like support some some of your mental health concerns?
I think it's a very fine line. Because part of me like wants to say like, oh, just be like understanding, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, I have phases of like being unresponsive because I just can't like mentally balance all the stuff I have going on. But also like a different part of me wants to say like hold us accountable. Like, mm-hmm. Like that's a very fine line to walk between like being understanding of what somebody's going through, but then also trying to like remind them like, you know, this is not a healthy behavior because you never want to make it so that it's harder for someone to go through what they're already experiencing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's definitely not a healthy thing to allow someone to just, you know, wallow in whatever misery or like stress they're feeling because, mm-hmm. you know, that doesn't really help anything.
Yeah, I think I learned from like someone before that because like people who have, for example, people who have suicidal thoughts, it's definitely a good idea for you to reach out to them very often because like as they were telling me, like when they have suicidal thoughts, like sometimes when they're alone, like they see a window, they just think that, you know, I just want to jump off from here. So like it's really important for them to not be alone. And so that's why as a friend, I think it's really important for me to like check in with them and like to think about them all the time because they're my good friends and to just like try to say that I'm always here if you need me.
Yeah, I think it's like also like I think that's definitely helpful. It's just like doing it in a way that's not
very bothersome, I guess.
Not intrusive.
Yes, like not unintentionally pressuring the person because like there's a big difference between being like, you're still alive, right? And being like, hey, we're still meeting this time, right? Like, yeah.
I feel like just socializing in general is very helpful. Just like reaching out, making sure that it needs to be done in a non-patronizing way. It needs to be mm-hmm. done out of real concern and real sympathy for that particular person. And in my opinion, like, leave the advice, like, leave the, like, where, like, advice for, like, the professional, like, professional psychologists, professional counselors, but you can be a sympathetic listener and can be there to just,
mm-hmm.
to be present and, like, and be sympathetic. That's, I mean, I'm repeating myself, but
mm-hmm.
there's definitely some things that you cannot do if you're not professionally trained.
Yeah. So I guess for the last part of our podcast, I wanted us to focus more on the external factors. So what do you guys think Georgetown or higher education in general is doing well or not doing so well on students with mental health concerns, and how would you suggest them to improve on in terms of the services and support that they have on mental health?
I laugh because I was very involved with fighting the Georgetown administration regarding their mental health policy.
Yes, exactly. That's why I wanted to ask you.
I was like, oh, spicy.
Spicy.
But basically, like the campaign that I was involved in was trying to make sure university funds students who are referred out of the university counseling service mm-hmm. to external counselors because to give them a stipend because, you know, therapy is expensive. It's very expensive. Right. And if you don't have the right insurance, it's not going to be covered. And it generally, at least in the DC area, costs about $200 a session, which of course, like my college student with no job cannot afford. But like that particular concern, it springs from the fact that there are not enough staff at the at the on-campus facility, right? But that concern is harder to address. Therefore, the stipend program really helps students that need long-term mental health services but have financial difficulty that makes it
mm-hmm.
hard to do so. So mm-hmm. that was one of the ways I tried to push for it,
mm-hmm.
Along with the people in the student association who has tried to make this campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like the root cause of it is cultural. It definitely depends on how, like, the school, like, that elite institution or that higher education institution at, like, frame their academic system, like, how, like as long as the grind culture is there, I don't think that, like, the mental health epidemic is ever gonna get better.
Yeah,
like, there needs to be a more, there needs to be a healthier relationship with students, extracurricular activities, and then classes. Mm-hmm. Because, like, the more competitive it becomes, the more bad for mental health it becomes as well.
Yeah.
So it's almost like an unsolvable problem. But I feel like definitely students these days have much more workload and much more expectations on them than what higher education was like before.
Yeah.
And institution needs to definitely acknowledge that and maybe think about curriculum reform.
Yeah,
that might be necessary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I definitely agree that it goes hand in hand with the stress culture. I also heard from you and some other friends of mine about CAPS, the psychiatry services, the mental health services, mm-hmm. at Georgetown, and how long you guys have to queue for even, like, one counseling session.
Oh, for you to wait for each
session? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I heard
the
you.
The queue is very long, and I only, like, I was part of the CAPS for a year, and this is because I have an ongoing issue, according to their label. They referred me out sophomore year because they didn't want students to be in the system for longer than a year. And, I mean, not to compare Georgetown to my preparatory school, but I am. My preparatory school, pretty much, like, throughout the 4 years that a student attends, they can have a counselor. So it definitely is a financial constraint, and also the concern of, you know, I mean, it's a different concern because preparatory school, the students are minor, and the school is kind of, you know, liable if the student is has to drop out or, like, have medical leave issues, whereas as a higher education, everyone's an adult, and when there's an adult, the legal liability isn't there, so that's why they are less willing to provide as much service as, you know, a preparatory school might provide. So, I mean, not gonna go down into the legal drama here, but it's definitely that assumption that college students are adults that do affect that decision. But I feel like college students are transitioning. It's a transitional state, mm-hmm. between, you know, teenagehood and adulthood, or basically called young adults. Like, there definitely needs to be more, you know, empathy towards students who are struggling, because not every student who attends an elite higher education institution are familiar with the stress culture, or are familiar with the amount of workload and, you know, mm-hmm. socializing and clubs and all these multiple things that are all new and requires a lot of adjustments. So I feel like if there's anything I want to summarize for my long rant, it's for the institution, for the administration to be more sympathetic towards its students and not look at them as, like, students who pay tuition to attend, but as human beings.
I think part of the difficulty with addressing the stress culture part is that it really is embedded in the students. Like, it's not just an administration thing, like, you know, it's not just, mm-hmm. the career center always having events about getting your next internship or, like, you know, balancing your club leadership. Like, it's also embedded in the students, because I can remember as a freshman, like, hearing someone older than me tell me, like, oh yeah, you should get, like, 5 classes and, like, 3 extracurriculars and then, like, 2 jobs, and I was like, how are you supposed to balance all of that and, like, still have, mm-hmm. friends and, like, do all these things that make you happy
and eat and sleep.
Yes. And then I very quickly, like, fell out of that, because I was like, that doesn't sound, like, you know, good for you.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, like, embedded in the students. Like, it very easily gets to you when all your social media and, like, you're, you know, you're encouraged to have LinkedIn and all this stuff, and all you're seeing is, like, people being like, oh, I landed this big internship, or, you know, like, oh, if you're not doing an internship this summer, you should be doing this. And like that gets to you even if you try to resist it. Cause like I worked summer job on campus for the first and second summer. Mm-hmm. And I decided to go home the third summer, but I very quickly started to get stressed, like, oh, I haven't landed an internship yet, even though I've had a job the past two summers. I feel stressed that I have no experience.
That's definitely me.
I mean, I really hate it because I always feel like a black sheep when I'm on the Georgetown campus. But sometimes, like, there's this debating self of, like, the hyper-competitive me that pretty much got me where I am. And then, like... the raised Buddhist me, it's like, you don't have to compete, you can just take it slow, you can just breathe, like, they can grind, you can just stay here, and you just feel like, why can't you manage the same amount of workload as other people? But then the answer is pretty simple. It's because it's you, you're not other people. Like, some people can do it and sometimes you can. There's no point to comparison, because not like, people aren't machineries. Like, people have different skills and different strength levels and different, you know, exhaustion level and different backgrounds. So like competing as if everyone starts from the same with the same stats does not bring you any good.
To the CAPS point, the psych services point, like, yeah, the long, like, the fact that there is the status and like the known issue among the students of the wait times and the fact that they'll refer you out if you need long-term help, like, that is a reason why I never went throughout the entire time, because like I didn't want to have to worry about it. I didn't want to have to deal with it.
And that's concerning as well, because there's definitely people who would really benefit from having access to mental health services, but since it's common knowledge that the line is very long and it's not that accessible, the people who need it most might not get it. So there's definitely that accessibility issue that needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Not only at Georgetown, but pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, I've had like a professor and a supervisor both tell me like, oh, you should go to CAPS if you're, you know, struggling with the stuff you mentioned to me. And then my immediate like internal thought is like, yeah, go to CAPS and then what? Like nothing happens. I don't get, if like at best I get an appointment that might not be for like 3 months. Like,
yeah. Well, that was it for episode 3 of Gen Z Talks. Thank you guys so much, Zania and Anna, for giving me your time to discuss this problem. And for all the listeners, if you are liking my content, please don't forget to like and subscribe to my channel for more contents. We'll see you next episode.